Take your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80. Of course, ESPN News, I'm Jason Fitz. Let's get you started off this hour like we do every hour with headlines that you need to know. It starts with some encouraging New York news. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is encouraging major sports teams in the state to plan on reopening without fans. His quote, hockey, basketball, baseball, football, whoever can reopen, we're a ready, willing, and able partner. I think this is in the best interest of all people, in the best interest of the state of New York. So that's obviously one step towards it. And next up in the headlines, as tweeted out by Barrett Salee, State University Systems of Florida are set to reopen campuses in the fall. That includes Florida, Florida State, UCF, USF, FAU, FIU, FAMU, and others. They put out a press release letting everybody know that they're at least looking at every opportunity and they are planning on reopening campuses. So yet again, this is becomes part of the what are we going to do when some schools are open and others may not be. And lastly, if we are going to reopen and we do get any NBA action, we have a Woj bomb. In what promises, according to him, to be a difficult loss to a Western Conference playoff contender, Utah Jazz forward Bojan Bogdanovic, one day I'm going to say Bogdanovic without stumbling, is undergoing season-ending surgery on his right wrist, sources have told ESPN. So the injury occurred in January against Indiana, and at this point he's had to undergo surgery. So even if the NBA comes back, Bogdanovic will not. Those are the headlines you need to know. First, take your take on ESPN Radio, ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80, and ESPN News. ESPN Radio presented by Progressive Insurance. This is shower season sessions. We're going to try this again. Part interview, part concert, all from the shower. Grammy winner St. Vincent invites up-and-coming artists to sing, share, and get funky all in the sound booth of their home, The Shower. Watch now at youtube.com/progressive. Every time I read that, I feel a little weird because, let's face it, we're all trying to figure out what everybody else is singing in the shower. And as much as I love y'all, I'm not ready to go there. We are going to keep asking you guys what athlete or team you want the next Last Dance doc to be on. 888-SAY-ESPN, 888-729-3776. You can also tweet me at Jason Fitz. We'll get more of your take coming in just a moment. But first, I want to get some expertise on what we've just seen. So to do that, we're joined now by Chicago Tribune Bulls beat writer during the 90s, now NBC Sports Chicago Bulls insider Casey Johnson joins us. Casey, thanks so much for your time. I hope you and yours are safe. Really appreciate you coming on. Now that the Last Dance is complete and having been around so much of that, especially that second three-peat, did we get it right in the storytelling of it?
I mean, there was a lot of tension around that team, and the dynasty kind of had the feel for it coming to a close. And Michael Jordan is a competitive guy. I mean, you know, those are all accurate things. I did feel like it was more of a Jordan documentary than a Bulls documentary, which is absolutely fine. I'm not being critical of the filmmakers. Michael does not do a lot of these interviews, and when you get him to cooperate, you got to take full advantage of it. And I thought his interviews were clearly, to me, the most compelling aspect of the documentary because it showed who he really is and what we all knew he was when we covered those teams back then. So, it absolutely was accurate. It was a good summation of that time in Bulls history.
Okay, so much like a Netflix series that ends season one and you can't wait for season two, I felt like that's what happened at the very end. Even though we're not getting a season two of this, when we find out that at least Reinsdorf was open to bringing everybody back for a seventh season, when you saw that, what was your reaction?
My reaction was we covered that. I mean, this is a part of the documentary that's been a little bit weird for those of us who were there, is that a lot of people are acting like this is all like news or stuff, and that that's not how we remember it. I mean, we covered all that. I mean, it got as surreal as this. At Tim Floyd's introductory news conference, he was introduced as the director of basketball operations. He was not even introduced as the head coach, because if Phil was going to come back, they wanted to leave that option open for him. Now, you can call that a PR stunt. You can call that disingenuous. You can call it whatever you want. But that's what happened. So it was not news. Now, that said, I agree with you. I personally thought the documentary was going to be more about the breakup of the dynasty. And really, to me, it was just that last 10 minutes of episode 10. Again, not being critical, it was captivating theater for 10 hours. It obviously binded the country and the world together at a difficult time for those who were interested in this subject matter. I certainly think that you could probably do a separate documentary just on you know, who's to blame or how it happened or the breakup or what have you. But as far as that being new, that's not the case. That was all covered way back then.
We're talking to NBC Sports Chicago Bulls insider Casey Johnson. And that's what I think is interesting, Casey, is like, as you're mentioning, it was covered in the time, but we spent so much of the first 9 hours really vilifying Jerry Krause as the one that ripped this apart. But at the end of the day, Phil Jackson was offered the opportunity to come back. So how should we view Phil knowing that he walked away from coming back to this team?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, here's the thing. Everyone wants black and white answers, particularly in this day and age. There's no black and white answer to this. It was just time. Those of us who are around that team felt that it was time. It just had that feeling of finality to it. So, yes, Phil was offered the opportunity to come back. You know, you can look at it from Phil's perspective for multiple ways. Number one, he had a theory, and he used this theory with the Lakers, too. This is not just a Bulls-centric thing. That a team got tired of your voice after 7 seasons. So, you know, you should move on after 7 seasons. He stayed 9 in Chicago because after the 7th season, they won a championship. He signed consecutive 1-season deals in 96 and 97 because he wasn't sure if he was going to come back even after they won the 5th championship. And so there was that aspect to it. And then, you know, maybe he walked away because he was tired of being around Jerry Krause. There was certainly an element to that. That relationship had run its course. So, you know, there's no black and white answer to this. Dynasties are hard for a reason. They're hard to keep together for a reason. There's a lot of powerful personalities and a lot of people needing to be on top of their game for a long time. I certainly understand, you know, why Michael wanted to get a chance to run it back and lose it on the court. But, you know, ownership and management went in a different direction back in 98. And that's something that they truly believe in.
We're talking to NBC Sports Chicago Bulls insider Casey Johnson. Should be noted that he wrote for the Chicago Tribune during this second three-peat that we've covered so much. So, Casey, you mentioned you guys covered it in the moment. How contentious was this team day in and day out from a covering them standpoint?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it because that's something I want to emphasize. Like, it was not this death slog. It was not like this tension-filled. It was not like this tension-filled, like, awful environment to be around. I mean, they were a championship team that won over 60 games in an NBA championship. There was plenty of moments of joy and levity and happiness. It was not like this, you know, bitter feud that was playing out on a daily basis. You know, and I think Phil deserves a lot of credit for that because even though he knew that he was leaving after the season, he kept, you know, the players focused. That was his great strength, is he kept the players focused on a goal and a task and did it in a mindful and present way. And, you know, that ceremony, that goodbye ceremony that they went into detail last night was really beautiful. And, you know, we remember that from back then. It wasn't something that came out actually in daily coverage, but it's something that came out over time. You know, and that's just Phil's masterful touch of just getting everybody to feel important and everybody to buy into a common goal. So, you know, I was a lot younger in my career then. I was in my late 20s. I might have turned 30. I'm 52 now. So, you know, I was wide-eyed and excited. So I also, you can't answer that question without my prism, which is, while I'm covering sports history as a young reporter for the Chicago Tribune, But it was definitely not like this drama-filled, angst-filled, tension-filled dynamic every day. That's just not the case.
We're talking NBC Sports, Chicago Bulls insider Casey Johnson, and you mentioned the prism. And I go back to, you know, my life at that point watching all of these games and, you know, having so much fandom involved in it. When I watched the documentary back, I don't know if it's just great filmmaking or if it's the way things went down. It just felt like we were constantly watching the Bulls in a tight game with 4 seconds left, and they always won them. So I ask you that because in the world where we look back at the record of the Bulls and how dominant they were, night in and night out, how dominant was this team on the floor?
Well, I mean, they won 72 games one season and went 6-0 in the finals. And in that first three-peat, I believe they went 8-2 on the road in the finals, which is almost unheard of over those three finals. So, I mean, obviously very, very dominant. They did miss one buzzer beater, but I actually thought that was my favorite scene, really. It's a small scene, but that was my favorite scene from the entire 10 hours was when Reggie Miller hit that game winner in game 4 of the 98 conference finals and Larry Bird just is completely expressionless because, you know why? Greatness recognizes greatness. And he knew there was 1.1 seconds left on that clock. And Jordan almost hit a miraculous double pump three-pointer in that game four. And to me, what was easily their toughest test in that second three-peat, that 98 conference finals was really in the balance, even in the game seven back in Chicago. So I love that scene. I love, you know, Jordan actually did miss every once in a while, but he obviously made a lot more than he missed.
Well, and I get the dominance in the record, and of course that can't be questioned. I think what is stunning to me is the concept of, as Reggie Miller called it, championship DNA is just championship DNA. But to see time and time and time again them have the ability to win that game on that last shot, what was the key for that? Was that a Michael thing? Was that a Phil thing? Like, what was the key for them always seeming to find the way to win these incredibly close games year in and year out?
Here's the thing about dynasties. The reason they happen is because a lot of people are really, really, really good at their jobs at the same time. So I'm not trying to evade the question, but it's, again, a multi-layered answer to me. Jerry Krause, really good at his job. Phil Jackson, really good at his job. Michael Jordan, probably the best ever at his job. Scottie Pippen, really good at his job, and on and on and on. So the reason that DNA, which I agree existed, it's a good question, it's because so many people were on point at the same time over a long period of time. I'm not trying to be cliche or evade the question. I just think it was a multi-layered aspect to it. It speaks to the leadership structure that Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause put in place and that Phil enacted in his unique way. And it speaks to the greatest competitor to me in sports history, in Michael Jordan, and everybody following his lead.
So you've got Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf who've done an amazing job of putting this team together. I mean, as much as Jerry Krause was the villain of this thing, we have to remember that he put this roster together time and time again. What's stunning to me is that now we have Michael Jordan, the team owner. At what point do we look at Michael Jordan, the team owner, and just wonder why the version we saw of Michael Jordan in The Last Dance hasn't translated to any success from a team ownership standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say this, like, you know, as I said before, he doesn't do many interviews now, but one thing I would love to do as a current journalist is to, you know, just ask him what his view of Jerry Krause is now that he's sat in that chair. I mean, it's not an easy job. Phil Jackson, team president of the Knicks, not an easy job. You know, Phil acknowledged Jerry in his introductory news conference in New York and said that that's a model that he was going to, you know, that he would like to emulate. So that to me was like a shout out to Jerry back then. But, you know, Michael, you know, has to, in my estimation, have a greater appreciation for what Jerry Krause did, you know, having sat in that chair. When Jerry passed in 2017, I was still at the Tribune, and I reached out to Michael's publicist, and Michael provided a nice statement about Jerry's impact on Chicago and sports. So that was obviously a nice gesture of Michael to acknowledge Jerry's passing in 2017. But yeah, it's a hard job, man. And you know, he Jerry Krause inherited Michael Jordan. There's no getting around that. But I always like to say he put the framer on the Mona Lisa, and he did it in really expert fashion.
That is beautifully stated. I'm going to steal that every time I talk to my friends about it in the future. Casey, we really appreciate your insight on this. Thanks so much for taking the time and giving us some insight from so many different perspectives around it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Check him out on NBC Sports, Chicago Bulls insider KC Johnson with the Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. We're going to keep the Straight Talk coming, and it comes in the form of BJ Armstrong, who joined First Take today and talked about his impression of the Last Dance finale and the Bulls' second three-peat. This is what he said when he joined Max and Stephen A.
No, he wasn't a bully, and but I can get and I can understand how they could be perceived that way, especially from the outside looking in. It was very clear when you played with him and you were in that locker room that you had to have your full commitment. You know, not only coming to practice and doing the things and saying you're doing the things, your words, your actions, and your behavior had to be inside those lines. And he wanted to make sure that we all wanted to make sure that I can tell you, especially on the first, you know, three-peat, is that we were all committed to this process. And the thing that, you know, they really didn't touch on, and I think every guy that played on those teams with him would understand, is we policed ourselves. We were very physically We were a good team physically, but, you know, mentally we were a very strong group. And we policed ourselves. Everyone understood what we had to do. We were constantly challenging ourselves. So he wasn't a bully. It's just, but I could see how people could say that because he was the best player. The camera was always on him. But one thing that we can say about Michael Jordan, not only could he, you know, dish it out, he could take it. He was very, very mentally tough that way. And we respected that about him, and he respected that about us. But he had to make sure because we knew what we had to do if we were going to be crowned champions.
BJ, I want to ask you a personal question I haven't heard you answer yet. Obviously, you're a huge part of that first three-peat, and then not being there for that second three-peat. How much did you think about that?
Well, you know, I knew, especially in particular, two guys there, Scottie and Michael, and, you know, that was, I was really happy for those guys because, you know what, you know what goes through the process. The thing that I was most impressed with that those guys were doing it, in particular, Michael, was Michael had to reinvent himself. You know, he wasn't the same player physically with the last three that he was in the first three. The first three, he was just a physically dominating, incredible athlete who just had the energy. He was just you know, he was just like a force of nature. The second three, you know, mentally, I think it was probably the most challenging for him because he had to find a way to get the results that he wanted, but do it in a different way. So I think both of those opportunities presented different challenges for him, but really watching him and the way he was able to do it, because he had to really reinvent how he played, the things he was doing. He was shooting fadeaway jump shots. In the second three, he was basically a 6'6 center. He played the game below the free throw line. Scottie became more of a facilitator, even more so than he was in the first three, and he really had to manage the game. So I thought that was the genius part of how they were able to construct that team around really where Michael was at physically and mentally as a player and get the same results. So, you know, bravo to those guys because it takes a toll on you, on your body to be able to play, let alone be able to go into that depth every single year and go into the how long they were going into the playoffs. So give those guys credit for being able to do that and figuring it out.
BJ, knowing how the game was played back then and knowing what you know about the game today, along with today's players, who do you think would have excelled in the previous era, the Jordan era? When you look at today's player, no matter what, who do you think would have excelled?
Well, you know, if you're a player, you're a player, and you know, I don't care what era you are, but you know, there are a few players. I think about that all the time, and one of the players I think would excel most in that era would be Klay Thompson. Klay Thompson, I think, is equipped to play in that era because of the way he played. You know, he's a big guard. I think he has the physicality of the game. And he played the game in the way that they all played. You know, you ran plays, your two guard had to provide spacing, and you had to be able to take your matchup. I think he was big enough to take that matchup every single night. I just think he would be a player that would fit into that era beautifully because of, you know, how he plays the game now. I think it translates. But you know what? I think the obvious, you know, you look at LeBron James, you look at Kawhi Leonard, you look at these guys, but Klay Thompson to me is a player that I said, you know what, he was a prototypical two guard that would fit very nicely into that era and the way they played the game back then.
That's some Straight Talk Wireless, everything for less, only at Walmart. We're getting the Straight Talk from you guys. If you could see a Last Dance documentary on any team or athlete, what would it be? Who would it be? Ken in Florida, what's your take on this one?
I believe the Edmonton Oilers of the mid to late 80s. I would love to see something about how that owner had to dissolve that team because of the economics.
I think that's a great call, especially if you tie it in to obviously Gretzky going to L.A. and what it meant for the Kings. So, you know, I've had a few tweets on Gretzky, following Gretzky from Edmonton to L.A. would be the ultimate because, again, you're talking about a level of star power. You're talking about a level of behind the scenes. You're talking about a level of things that we haven't necessarily seen before. I think all of that together makes sense for why it would work really well together. Kiefer in New Hampshire. Kiefer, what's your take on this? What do you want to see a Last Dance documentary on?
I'd love to see how about the Buffalo Bills going to four straight Super Bowls and not winning it?
Oh, you are a glutton for punishment, my friend, a glutton for punishment.
I know, but just imagine, like, what it would be like, especially that fourth Super Bowl after going to three and then going to that fourth one. Just imagine what they went through, like, in the locker room and stuff. That must have been crazy.
No, look, I think it's a great idea. If you could get it behind the scenes, if there was any footage of that. And that's one thing that I think we're starting to realize. Look, The Last Dance was partially about the great footage we have from Jordan's team following him everywhere. But one of the things that made it truly special in storytelling to me was looking back at some of the earlier games that we don't even think about that are still out there. You know, game footage and the behind the scenes conversation and mic'd up footage. I think we're going to see more and more of that as people are looking back into the archives to find new and imaginative ways to show us classic games. At least I hope that that's what we see. Speaking of things that we'll see, we're going to take more of your take, who you want to see the next Last Dance on. Plus, someone you saw throughout the Last Dance documentary going to join us next. First, take your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80, and ESPN News. I'm Jason Fitz. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. Don't forget the All In Challenge fundraiser. Keeps offering really cool sports experiences you can enter to win. And it all supports organizations providing food to those in need. Time's running out, but you can still enter to win a VIP experience at the MLS All-Star Weekend, or enter to win an incredible X Games Aspen experience that gives you behind-the-scenes access to the competition and the music festivals. How awesome is that? Both those sweepstakes close tomorrow. If you get out there and you see things that you can't afford to actually get into the auction fund on, enter to win is just like a raffle. 10 tickets, 10 bucks. You can go out. You can make a difference. Remember, 100% of the money raised, every single dollar raised, benefits organizations providing food to those in need. If you're able right now, these are tough times for a lot of people. So I know every dollar matters. But if you've got a few dollars to spare and you want to participate or just learn more about how all of these organizations work, all you got to do is visit allinchallenge.com. It's that simple. Allinchallenge.com. You can get out there. You can make a difference and you can help. In these times, every dollar makes a difference. So we're going to keep taking your take of what athlete or team do you want the next Last Dance documentary to be on. Have fun to look back in history and see who we wish we could get the behind the scenes look at. 888-SAY-ESPN, 888-729-3776. But instead of just talking about The Last Dance with each other, let's talk to somebody that was actually in the documentary throughout, New York Times bestselling author of The Jordan Rule. Sam Smith joins us now. Sam, first and foremost, thanks for your time. I hope you and yours are safe. Really appreciate it. I want to ask you directly, now that you've seen the entire documentary, how do you feel about the way that you particularly were portrayed in this?
Well, my only concern was this Jordan guy kept getting involved in one of my all my airtime. You know, we could have spent a little more time on my set. No, we're all in Michael Jordan's world. You could see we're all just asteroids flying around on and off for his benefit, one way or another. But It was sort of a surprise, actually. I mean, I know I was involved early on, but I think I told somebody, I said, you know, I've kind of been in the same place for a long time, and the circus came back to my front doors. I just opened it up, and there they were again. So it was great to, you know, it was great to look back, you know, to have people, you know, fans get an appreciation, not for me, but for that era. And I think the enlightening part of it for so many, even in Chicago, people who saw it just didn't really have a great feel for all the internal behind the scenes, behind the curtain kind of stuff that was daily life for all of us. And, you know, I had chronicled some in the Jordan Rules book in 1991, but, you know, how that transpired throughout the 90s and how this team, amidst all that, this incredible celebrity and bizarre behavior with Rodman and, you know, Phil stuff and everything, and how that coalesced to be continued to be the success year after year was, I think it was just an eye-opening story for even people who knew the story.
We're talking to New York Times bestselling author of The Jordan Rule, Sam Smith. And that's a great point, Sam, and one that really leads me to a thought line for this. We live in a world now where social media really impacts the coverage of every sport, but particularly with the NBA. If social media had existed, what effect would that have had on a team that was as big personality-wise that had the conflict behind the scenes that the Bulls had?
I don't think it would have been really tremendously different. I just think there would have been so much, even more discussion, debate, one side, you know, people on social media, because so many people have voices who didn't have voices before, can express them. And so there'd be so much, you know, positive, negative observation. But still, that team, Well, what it came down to essentially is them succeeding. If they had not succeeded to that level, it never would have been not only that team, but it wouldn't have been discussed to that, you know, to that maximum effect so often. So it just would have enhanced the personalities even more, if that's possible. And you know, those were remarkable personalities. I guess they showed it, but the things that went on, you know, Rodman dressing himself up. I remember that scene walking down Michigan Avenue in his wedding dress. We didn't know what was actually going on. You know, it's hard to communicate with Rodman under the best of circumstances. And so it turned out he was marrying himself for a book promotion. And so this kind of stuff, like went on daily kind of behavior. Dennis took off many times on things. We saw the wrestling thing and, I think it was South Carolina during the finals where he just sort of hopped off. But almost every time we go into Philadelphia, he'd disappear and be in Atlantic City that next day. You know, so it would just be mathematical to the, you know, nth power. But it still would have been a remarkable, you know, continuing story because of the success. And that's what it comes down to.
Well, and you mentioned giving an additional voice. Craig Hodges has been pretty loud that he thinks that Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen, some of those guys were portrayed poorly or were treated poorly during that time. You were around this team. What was sort of the sense of relationship between those guys and Michael?
Well, you know, Michael, he sort of came out, if you would, you know, all these years and actually – Not that I need it. I had a great career at the Chicago Tribune, where I worked in 2008 and written several books, you know, since the Jordan Rules, and now I write on the Bulls website. So, for most of the time, Michael had gone reclusive basically the last two decades. So the notion was often that he was depicted inaccurately or unfairly, and you know, wasn't quite this dictator that, and now he's come out in this thing and said, well, yeah, of course I was. That's the way I treated people, and the notion is that's what leadership is about. You know, that's what you need to win. And whether his view of leadership may not be different from Magic's view, which was successful in his way too, but you know, Michael's narrative is that's what I felt I needed to do, and so those issues existed, you know, with those guys at the time. What the documentary didn't make clear and expressed his frustrations, but in effect, it was the timing of all these things. Because when Jordan came along in the first in 84, you know, beginning, it was a veteran group. And so the ownership took over, new ownership changed in Jordan's rookie year, in the middle of his rookie year. And they didn't announce it back then like they do now, but they basically did a tanking thing. Except they did it with, you know, Michael Jordan as a front man, sort of like you break up the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger stays, and then you get a bunch of street musicians to be a background. So Michael is drawing the attention while management is basically getting rid of the high-level players they had or higher level for future picks, which became Grant and Pippen and Armstrong and all these guys who were on the championship team. So Michael grows frustrated all these years trying to compete with Bird and Magic in U 86, 86, 87, 88. And so now he's 6-7 years into his career and playing with these kids. So, you know, he's sort of the adult in the room, frustrated, competitive, compulsive, as we've seen all his behaviors. And so pushing these guys a lot harder than perhaps normal if they'd been on the same plane. And then when he leaves and comes back, with the celebrity he had, it's a whole new group of people and basically guys who are virtually out of the NBA. Steve Kerr, you know, he was going to go to play China. His NBA career was about over. Bill Wennington had been in Italy. And so they had a lot of sort of scrap pieces there and who Michael didn't even know. So again, he sort of had to take this role of, you know, sort of herding cats in a way. And so, you know, with Michael's, and it wasn't mean-spiritedness to me, being around him all the time. It was sort of a fun, challenging nature. And I think that's come through, too. And so, you know, those guys had each other all the time. And I don't feel that they suffered particularly under his wrath on a general basis. But, you know, it was a challenge that, you know, I think it showed you know, their high level of character, that they rose to it, and he wasn't going to be able to intimidate them.
We're talking to Sam Smith, author of The Jordan Rules. So with all of that context about what he's went through as a player and seeing the different ownership, why has Michael Jordan, in your mind, not been able to translate what he watched the Bulls do as a team into his own career as an owner of a team in the NBA?
Pretty simple. It couldn't do it itself. You know, everything Michael achieved, basically, was through his efforts. You know, and look, he is probably the great, you know, it's an arbitrary thing, greatest player. But, okay, say he's the greatest player. That was him at the end of the game. I mean, the end of the Utah game was the perfect, you know, the perfect denouement, as it were, the conclusion of a career. It's great they didn't play, you know, he came back with Washington. We sort of forget that in some respect. But it's great that he didn't play again with the Bulls, because look what he did down the stretch on offense and defense. They didn't show the whole sequence. And Bob Costas, you know, mentioned he, in passing. But there was this, you know, offense, defense, intelligence, awareness, so many elements that sort of summed up his entire career and why he was so, you know, why he was so special and why he transcended so many other players. And he did all these things basically over a minute in time. And so, you know, he could do it. He could put his finger on it and he could change reality by what he did. When you become an owner, you know, a manager, like he did first with Washington, he was a GM, actually, you can't do it yourself. And so it justified what the Bulls were doing and holding off against him. It was very unpopular for Jerry Krause, obviously, come through in a lot of the documentary and Bulls organization, to have defied Michael all those years. But back in the back, you know, Michael, as I mentioned before, Michael's growing frustrated in the late 80s with young players being brought in and all that. So he's lobbying. He doesn't want Grant and Pippen on the team. He wants Buck Williams and Walter Davis, you know, two veterans, you know, guys who are all-star level players, ACC, which helps. And he's urging management to get rid of all these guys, and management's holding off, saying, no, you don't win that way. He doesn't want Bill Cartwright. He wants Oakley, because Oakley's his closest friend on the team, his protector against the Pistons. You know, Bill is not that kind of guy. But those are the elements you needed to build a team. So the coaching staff and management together, because Phil Jackson and Doug Collins had a lot to do with those transactions too, you know, they're all holding off Michael. But you become an owner of GM, now you've got the final word. And the fact of the matter is, I think because of his wanting to have things happen so quickly, he's impatient as an owner and an executive, and just wasn't great at building things, as he wouldn't have been if the Bulls had followed what he wanted, his recommendations, when he was a player. And to their credit, they didn't. And he's prospered as well. And he came around to admit, as he admits to Jerry Reinsdorf now when they sit in the Board of Governors meeting, running a team, I know he said this to them, running a team is a lot harder than I thought it would be. And so I think he's given sort of apologies to them in some respects.
You can follow him on Twitter at Sam Smith Hoops. Obviously, check out The Jordan Rules. Sam, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for the extra insight.
Okay, good to talk to you.
Oh, man, just great insight on it. And what he says there at the end, really incredible that he's actually come out and admitted, you know, it wasn't as easy. It's one of the most difficult things to do is to figure out legacy and how we're going to view Jerry Krause through all of this. He's the person that built it, but he's also the person that dismantled it. We're going to keep taking your take. What athlete or team do you want to see the next Last Dance type documentary to be on? Plus, we'll continue our NBA primetime player countdown list. Who's at number 10? You'll find out next. First, take your take on ESPN Radio.
Regular season MVP has never motivated me. To be the best to ever play the game has motivated me.
We're counting down the NBA's best with our First Take primetime players. That's pretty interesting. Each day, we'll reveal and debate a player from our top 15 ranking as voted on by our ESPN NBA experts. Who's in? Who's out? Who's number one? You'll know I'll have something to say about all this. First Take NBA primetime players, Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Eastern on ESPN.
Well, if they're giving you primetime players, then we're going to react to them. First, take your take on ESPN News. We continue the primetime player rankings. Let's find out who came in at number 10.
The 10th player in our First Take Primetime Players NBA ranking is Nikola Jokic. His 40 triple-doubles ranked 10th in NBA history.
Joker does it again with another nifty dime.
Wild shot by Jokic. Oh, are you kidding?
Jokic leads Denver in total points, assists, and rebounds this season, something he's done each of the last two seasons. Nikola Jokic.
First, take your take on ESPN News. So Jokic is in at number five. So obvious, or at number 10, obviously a little surprising to me. I'm surprised that maybe it's just the lack of love we give the Nuggets. I'll be interested to see where the rest of this list goes. But the Nuggets are a team that we don't give enough credit to. Jokic feels like the type of player that we don't give enough love to. I don't know why there isn't more of a marketable spell for him. I don't know why he doesn't get more love. You can continue to listen to that all week, by the way. They'll continue to break down the top 10 players. We're going to get the rest of that list this week. If you missed the second hour of today's show, go check it out. It's on demand in the First Take Your Take podcast brought to you by Capital One. Capital One, you can open a new checkings or savings account. No fees or minimums. Welcome to Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Approval required. Capital One, NA member FDIC. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. Let's get some of your take. Who do you want to see the next Last Dance documentary on? Chewy in California. Give us what you got, my friend.
Hey, Fitz, what's going on, dude? I would like to see the Big Red Machine, the team of the decade in the 80s, all through that 70s year. They have a bevy of all-stars. We can go down the list and start naming on that club, let alone they had what was called the Great Eight, which I believe in the eight starters in a stretch of 88 games. They went 69-19. They were probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, baseball team ever assembled for a decade. They dominated the National League. Plus, it might give us some insight on Pete Rose and what was going on with him and how it was playing with him. I know him and Johnny Bench had a big riff, and then their Hall of Fame manager, Sparky Anderson, is also involved. So, that's the Phil Jackson. I think we got the makings of something very similar here.
Look, I like a lot of what you're saying there for that one. Although, if we're going to pick traumatic years in baseball, I've had several tweets for the 88 A's. You get a little bit of the Smash Brothers, maybe some steroid controversy. You get Hernandez. There's a lot of good from that one as well. It's part of what's interesting is trying to find the right pinpoint, the right time to look back towards or look back to. And I think part of what we have to look back at is the insight that you gain in seeing all of this. You get the opportunity to learn so much more behind the curtain. Like, we've learned so much more about not just Michael Jordan, but the entire Bulls team. How many people felt like they came away from episode 9 connected at a different level to Steve Kerr? That's what made this thing so incredible. Is it wasn't just about Jordan, although much of the coverage was. It was much of it was the peek behind the curtain and everybody else. And thanks for hanging out with us today.